You're listening to the Mazingo Baseball Podcast. We're bringing in some of the best baseball minds you can find anywhere. I'm your host, Harold Mazingo. Before we get started, make sure you subscribe, give us a rating, share with your friends, do whatever you got to do so we can keep this train rolling. Now let's dive in. All right, we're making history here today. We got our first in-person podcast episode here with Ryan Arowano. First off, Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be making history.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ryan got some exciting news earlier this week, and Ryan, I want you to kind of share that with everybody, then we'll get into your story.
Yeah, so I just accepted a job with the New York Mets as an associate in amateur scouting for 2024.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. So let's talk a little bit about the process with you, what you were doing last year, what your background is, and what you'll be doing going forward.
Yeah, so I went to college and studied computer science and data science while playing baseball, but injuries kind of limited the playing baseball part of that. So after college, I worked for the Red Sox in video and technology last year. So I was at the High A affiliate with the Red Sox at Greenville. And I just did what I did in here mostly when I interned with you, where setting up the technology, collecting all the data, and making sure that it was all in place for the coaches and players come game time. And now I'm leading into amateur scouting with the Mets.
All right, so you talked about interning here. I guess we should probably talk about that a little bit. Your time in here was invaluable for me personally, but you did a lot of good stuff in here. And how do you think that helped you for what you're doing, what you did last year, and what you'll be doing next year, and hopefully years to come?
Yeah, well, it was just as invaluable to me, too. So I wouldn't be where I'm at now if I didn't have the 3 or 4 years of experience with you. So I greatly appreciate that. But you gave me the opportunity to do my own research, come to my own conclusions, and work with all the technologies that we had, even though they're to a lesser degree than the technologies I was working with for the Red Sox. It still put me in a better position to get acclimated to all of those, like, Hawkeye, TrackMan, blast motion sensors. Doing all of that stuff kind of helped ease the leeway going into that. So I appreciate that. And then also getting to talk to the players and the parents also helped out with talking to the players and the coaches at Greenville.
Nice, nice, nice. So if anyone is listening and they haven't seen the work that we did with the WeBoard stuff, that wasn't just me. Ryan was a big part of that as well. Ryan, I want you to kind of talk about your experience with that WeBoard stuff, because it was kind of a weird but also very cool adventure that we went on with that.
Yeah, so applying for jobs this year, I got a lot of questions about that research project, which I thought was really cool because they took an interest in it, because I know we put a lot of work into it. So what it started as originally was, could we correlate shoulder forces to velocity production? And we started with that intention of going and using a WeBoard to determine before and after throwing, would this correlate to velocity both on the day and then trending over months, right? And then we kept experimenting with it, and more of the creativity came from your side, but the data application was on my side. But we came to an understanding that these are also correlating with the AC ratio for what was then MOTIS, but now the driveline pulse. So we started correlating that with the forces between the throwing arm and non-throwing arm to see if there are any differences between the throwing arm and non-throwing arm pre and post throwing. And we found that using the shoulder forces before throwing correlated pretty well with the AC ratio. So you could get a to-the-minute description of how a pitcher's feeling, both like body-wise and arm-wise, which stops a lot of the younger guys and guys who like to throw through injuries from throwing through injuries.
Yeah, so it was a really cool thing that we did there, and it's on my website somewhere. I'm not sure exactly where. I'll try to link it in the description on the show notes. But we did that with like one player in particular. I don't know if you remember the guy. We don't need to talk about his name, but we kind of accidentally, I think, led him down a path of velocity development by complete mistake, right? Mm-hmm. So he came in, I don't know where he was, like 78, maybe, left-handed.
Sounds right.
And when he got done with doing that, we were, by training those forces isometrically, pre and post throwing every day, in a few months' time, he was at 87, and that was really the only thing that I knew that he was doing different than anyone else at the time. And he was an older guy, so it wasn't like we had that adaptation window, right, where he's just coming in for the first time ever and doing that. So it was a really, really cool project that we did. One of the cool things that we also were doing with it was, when we were looking at the ground force stuff, was having the two computers kind of set up, right, and just watching guys try to create force down through not just the heel, but the entire foot as they went into the sit process. And that was only possible because we had two going at the same time. It was a really cool thing. So let's talk about what you'll be doing with the Mets on the amateur side here. So your big thing now will be the draft, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So you'll be looking at like who their big board, if you will, of college and high school players. So I know you're new to it, right? But have they kind of talked to you about any of the job description much at all yet?
Yeah, so they said that they hire someone who works with the data, which is something that I'll be doing, and then they'll hire someone else who is more on the field and doing more of the report writing. But through the data side, I'm collecting all the data and making sure that it's in the right places for every player that the Mets have data for. And I know that they said that they'll let me continue working on individual projects through their research and development team, which is also really cool for me and something that I wanted to pursue as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I don't know if you listened to the podcast I did with Mason McCray, but Mason does an extraordinary amount of work on the amateur side when it comes to scouting players. And just thinking about him for a minute here with this and you with what you'll be doing, we've come a long ways with the information available, right? And this season is supposed to be more about the youth side, but I think the high school side ties into youth for me. So there's a lot of high school players that may be listening, that may be getting ready for the draft process, or maybe have aspirations of the draft, right? This information is available at the college level. It's a little bit easier, right? Because you have so many of the TrackMan systems that spit the data out for you. But what about like the high school kids? Because that information can be a little bit more difficult. So they talk to you about like how it differs for high school versus the college level players with the data collection?
I haven't really talked to them about much of that yet. I'll wait until I actually get on the job to, well, delve into all of that. But just from like working in baseball last year, it was kind of confusing to see how they put together big boards for high school guys, because they do have data from either workouts at the facilities or like perfect games in like Arizona, for instance, where they have the TrackMan and Hawkeye data and even biomechanics data. So if you are that like top prospect, they're gonna have data for you. They'll have blast motion sensor for swing data, and then they'll have your pitch data through TrackMan or some other medium like that. But for other guys who can't get out to those events, I'm not really sure how that works yet. I'll figure it out this year. But I would assume it's just any way to get in front of a TrackMan or to get some swing data using a blast motion or Diamond Kinetics swing tracker that you can get for relatively cheap just to have data out there.
Yeah, and look, obviously things are a little bit different for the bigger Division I schools and some of the smaller Division IIIs and the JUCOs and stuff like that. But we've come a long ways with this stuff. A lot of the smaller, quote unquote, programs have really done a good job investing in the technology as well. So there is a lot of this stuff available. One of the cool things that happened for me in here, there was a player going through the draft process. You know who I'm talking about. I'm not going to mention his name on here, but he was going through the draft process, and the organization that was really big on it, they ultimately ended up drafting him. They called me to get that data on him, and one of the things that I really thought was really cool was they stayed in contact with me through his first few years in pro ball and wanted to know what we had worked on in here, what worked for him, what didn't, what I thought of some things, right? And I thought that was a really cool thing, and no different than like the college recruiting process, right? When the college coaches are trying to get as much information as possible. I think it's the very, a very similar thing, and even more scrutinized, right, on the professional level, right? So I think it is going to be a fun thing for you to do, and I think a lot of times you're going to have to get deep into the woods and figure out where these guys are training, who has access to it, because sometimes a one-time event can be very misleading as well. But it's a really cool thing you're going to do. So you talked about some projects you were still working on or maybe wanted to work on. What are some things, other than the WeBoard stuff that we did in here and the shoulder force stuff, what are some other things that you got in store?
Yeah, so currently my bigger project is trying to optimize pitcher arsenals. So instead of having an arbitrary way of saying, oh, he should probably throw this pitch more just based off of eye test and looking at the numbers, I'm trying to train machine learning models to be able to more aptly do that and optimize the arsenal based off of pitch metrics and pitch usage.
Nice. You want to give me an example? I'm intrigued by what you're talking about right now.
Yeah, so back in like 2020, 2021, when Kevin Gausman went to the Giants from the Reds, the biggest thing with him was upping his splitter usage. And it makes a lot of sense. It was his best pitch. You should throw that as much as possible given the other pitches that you have in your arsenal. Like, of course, he also has a good fastball and he has a good slider. So him throwing his splitter 40% of the time makes sense. And then throwing the fastball slider off of that makes a ton of sense. And it's caused him to be a perennial Cy Young candidate. So I wanted to do that where they optimize his arsenal, but for everyone all at the same time. So now I'm training models to try and figure out where pitchers are maybe excelling at and where they're missing out on.
Nice, nice, nice. So one of the big things that you hear about in professional baseball, not just professional baseball, but in baseball today, is the idea of the sweeper, right? And I know it kind of took over for a little bit, right? And now you're starting to see people kind of caution that maybe if it becomes enough of a commonality, right? If everybody's throwing a sweeper, then it sort of loses its lore, right? So where are you at with the slider stuff versus curveball and sweeper versus more traditional like gyro type slider?
I think it's just dependent on the pitcher. Like, you can't really sit here and say that a sweeper is going to work for everyone because not everyone has that supination bias when they throw. So like trying to teach a guy who throws a great changeup how to throw a good sweeper is probably going to be a little more difficult than say trying a splitter and hoping that there's a horizontal movement difference between the changeup and the splitter. So I think that if you find something that works into how your body naturally moves, that it's probably the best pitch for you. So if you throw from over the top, it's going to be easier to throw a better curveball than a better sweeper, right? And then off of that, you can throw a gyro slider to flick up there, right? And then versus if you are able to supinate very well, then throwing the sweeper and even a gyro slider too will also be effective in my opinion. So like I see in my research that generally sweepers and sliders perform better, but they perform better in 2022 than 2023. So without looking at the specific usage, maybe that they are getting a little bit worse just because they're seen more often. I still haven't concluded that in research, but it's a hypothesis as of right now.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, I mean, I think we always kind of go in waves of what's popular, what's not, right? The one pitch that has always kind of been an anomaly, especially here in America, is the splitter, right? We still don't have a ton of guys that throw splitters. Why do you think that is? And I know for me, before I let you talk about this, for me, I was just working with a high school program, and they had a guy that threw a splitter, and he said, well, I can't call it a splitter. And I said, well, that's fine. Call it a changeup, right? I don't care what you call it. Like, it essentially is a changeup. It's a variation of a changeup, right? But I think it has this negative connotation, especially in youth baseball and in America, and I think that kind of leads to it. But what are your thoughts on the splitter and why we don't see it much in America as opposed to the Asian countries?
Well, I know just based off of trying to throw one and seeing other people throw them, it's a lot harder to command. So if you're not able to throw it consistently around the strike zone, then you're either spiking it or it's sailing high in arm side. But I like the splitter. I think, and I've thought this for a little bit now that I think that the splitter is going to be the next like big wave. You're going to see more pitchers trying to throw splitters, and they're going to become as effective as sliders. They aren't yet, but I think they will be. But I think they're a really good pitch just because of how different they are. Studies show that pitches with more run towards batters perform worse. So a splitter kind of limits the depth and the horizontal movement, and splitters that stay around zero horizontal movement perform better than those who get run. So I think it's just finding what works for an individual pitcher. But I know Kevin Gausman, when he goes into a season, he doesn't throw a splitter all off season and just like when he's in a game, picks it up and throws it because it hurts his fingers to throw. So that goes into it too. People, especially after TJ, who did throw splitters beforehand, say that splitting the fingers and trying to rip it as hard as they can hurts their elbow. So that could also go into it. It's just a lot of different things that are keeping it from being this, like, as used as a slider. But I think one day it'll become more, I don't want to say accepted, but more practiced, and we'll find better ways to like teach it and develop it so that it'll become as used as a slider.
Yeah, nice. What are your thoughts on young kids learning off-speed pitches? Do you have any thoughts on when you think that should happen? What kind of breaking ball they should start with? Just share your thoughts on that.
I don't really have any preferences for what types of pitches they should be throwing and when. I think if their body allows them to move in a certain way, like maybe experimenting at like around the age of like 12, 13 is good. I know I learned a changeup really early on, but I didn't learn any like sliders or curveballs just because I was always told that those pitches are going to hurt your arm. Not that I prescribe to that now, because I think just throwing a ball as hard as you can puts more stress on your arm. But I think that if you're able to throw it and you're able to be consistent with it and you're able to do it without pain or affecting your athleticism at any point, then go ahead, be my guest and throw it. But if you're noticing that you have to move your body in a certain way that's uncomfortable to throw the pitch, then you probably should wait and hold off or find a different pitch to throw. So I'm not going to say that a kid should stay away from a curveball at the age of 12. But I will say if he has to change the way he throws, the way his arm naturally works in order to be able to throw the curveball, then he probably shouldn't be throwing the curveball.
Yeah, nice. Well said. All right, so let's talk. You played travel ball growing up. You've been through the high school ranks, the college ranks, and obviously last year you got to work with some professional guys. What do you see as the big difference between the different levels? And what is some of your advice? We'll shift to the high school guys here a little bit and just talk about like some of the advice you would give to the high school guys on how to sort of close that gap if their dreams and aspirations are to play this game for a long time.
Yeah, so the guys at the top levels, and especially where I was at in high A, the best guys were all extremely athletic, super talented, strong, everything that you could say about a good baseball player, they were. So for a high school guy, like, get in the gym, try to get bigger, faster, and stronger, and that's going to help you more than maybe anything else. Where it's just getting into the gym consistently, finding a routine that works for you that allows you to get bigger and faster and stronger. And then on the pitching side, having a radar gun. Right, having a radar gun early so that you can determine things that are working for you that are increasing velocity, because velocity is going to play up more as you increase in levels at the college level, lower minor leagues, upper minor leagues, Major League Baseball, velocity plays. And then hitters, trying to swing the bat as fast as you can at a young age, getting used to swinging 110% every swing that you can take, like trying to do weighted bat speed training early on, getting yourself to be fast rotationally and be able to drive the ball into gaps and in the air.
All right, what about from a routine standpoint? Was there anything that you saw that kind of stood out along the levels with the routines of the players?
Yeah, so where I was at, the players had a good amount of freedom of what they did pre and post throwing. So, of course, there were coordinators and coaches tailoring programs for all the hitters and the pitchers. But in the end, it is up to them. It's their careers to figure out what they want to do and what works for them. So there was a lot of communication of trying to figure out what works for everyone in that situation, and that's something that the coaches and the coordinators could all agree on. But the guys who did get that leeway were also extremely prepared and knew what they were doing. So they had their backgrounds from school and all that training from high school, college, up into pro ball now. So the guys who knew what they were doing were given that leeway, whereas the guys who didn't really have that focus going in got more attention from the coordinators and the strength coaches and pitching coach, hitting coach, all of that.
Yeah, so one thing that I noticed, or thinking back on, really, it really hits me a little bit different, was that what we see now at the youngest levels of the game is that everyone now is kind of growing up with instructors and different coaches for this and that, right? And it sort of seems like the younger players, like they're so used to people telling them what they're doing wrong on every single swing or every single throw that it's a struggle for them to have that freedom, because they need to know, like, what did I do wrong, right? And then as you get higher and higher into the game with the more talented players, they sort of have more ownership of what they're doing within their own body and system, right? So you're going to see, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I hope you saw this too, but you saw a ton of different guys doing different things and were able to get results in a vast majority of ways, not just, okay, why am I flaring everything to right field in this game, right? Or pulling off of balls, right? They'll start to figure some of that stuff out for themselves and do some stuff that they know works for that, versus a coach in there saying, hey, you know, you're pulling off because you're not doing this within your swing, you're not doing that within your swing, right? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think our coaches and coordinators did a really good job of stepping in when they needed to and knowing when the right time to bring a player in and just sit down and talk about what they're thinking about and what they're able to see. So knowing when to interfere with what a player is doing was extremely beneficial for a lot of the guys. And I know that the players really appreciated that. But even the players took initiative over that too, where if they wanted to, they would pull a coach aside and maybe a catcher would go over how he felt he handled the previous game with both pitch calling and framing. So they would pull a coach aside, ask their opinion, and then tell them what they thought about the game and try to come to a conclusion on how to better assess either a problem or better excel at something that's already a strength.
Yeah, I mean, because look, the best players, and this was an expression that I heard often, especially in pro ball, was that the best players can make adjustments on the fly, right? Like, whereas good players can make adjustments at bat to at bat, right? And average players can make adjustments from game to game, right? The best of the best were able to make those adjustments pitch to pitch, right? And it doesn't come from having a coach in your ear telling you what to do all the time, right? So we just need a little bit more freedom to fail, if you will. Like, this is a game of failure. In baseball, you're going to fail a lot. And it's like the young kids growing up now, if they fail, like, there's something wrong, right? Like, you're going to fail in this game. You're going to have to be okay with it. Just figure out how to make the necessary adjustments, right?
Yeah, that was a huge point throughout the entirety of the season. It's a 140-game season.
It's a grind.
Yeah. A lot of failure is going to happen. It's just learning to accept that and know that it's going to happen, and then try to figure out reasons why it happened and move forward with it instead of trying to repress it or even try and not deal with any of it and keep going. So I know that it was a huge point from the mental skills aspect of it, which the mental skills coaches did a really great job throughout the year with trying to console players that failure is a good thing. And especially when you're in high A like make those mistakes and get better because of them. Like, don't be afraid of trying something new for the sake of failure. Just try something new. If it doesn't work, figure out why it didn't work and learn from it.
Yeah, and fear of failure has held a lot of potential ball players back from ever reaching like their full potential, right? So like, I know at the younger levels, the coaches are so concerned, and the parents and the kids, with making that error, right? So they're afraid to try to make the great play, right? But you're never going to learn to make the great play if you don't try to make the great play, and failure is going to come along with that. You're going to have to mess it up over and over and over again in order to get it right. And so many are afraid of that, but that's the only way to chase greatness, is chasing or being okay with failing. But look, let's talk about this for a second. You now have a job with the Mets, which I think is pretty cool and near and dear to your heart. You grew up a Mets fan, correct?
Yes, correct.
All right, so we're going to do something a little bit different here. I want you to tell me, not that I expect you to be following what I put on Facebook, but I've been sort of doing this Mount Rushmore series. So I want your Mount Rushmore of Mets players. I need your top four Mets players. Who you got?
I think the first two are David Wright and Tom Seaver. Tom Seaver's the best Met of all time. David Wright's my favorite player of all time. It also helps that he's the best position player the Mets have ever had. So those two are going to go on my Mount Rushmore. Then the other two, it's difficult. I want to put a lot of different players here, but
I threw you on the spot here, but that's okay.
I want to include Dwight Gooden.
Doc was tough when he first got there, for sure.
Yeah, very, very good. And then the last, any combination of Keith Hernandez, Gary Carter, Daryl Strawberry, Jose Reyes.
Yeah.
Those players. It's kind of hard to narrow down one.
Yeah, Strawberry's probably like the biggest talent, right?
Yeah.
But it is also very hard to ignore Gary Carter's career and impact as a Met, right? Mm-hmm. So those are all good names. I appreciate that. Gary Carter just missed out on my Mount Rushmore catchers. So he was a name I really wanted to put on there. Just missed out a little bit. Mm-hmm. All right, so I just want you to talk about some advice you would have for the youngsters, especially now with travel ball being so prevalent, right? Some advice for the youngsters on how to navigate those sorts of things, just to tie it all back into youth development.
Yeah, I definitely have my regrets of how I handled the whole like travel ball and showcase route. I didn't really need to be in showcase games, because when I went to different schools and I did workouts at these different schools, that's where I got noticed the most. Like, playing on a showcase team never really got me anywhere. So I if I could go back, I would focus more on training in a facility with the guidance of someone who knows what they're talking about, and then also going to the schools that you already like academically and seeing the workouts that they do at whatever program that you want to go to. So I think that playing games is good, but it comes to a point where if you're just not good enough, then playing the games themselves isn't going to work out for you. But if you are good enough and you can get yourself out there, go to that showcase, but make sure that if you want to go to a school that you value, then go to their camps. I think that's where the benefit of their camps are, is you're able to go there, be one-on-one with the coaches, showcase your skills. Because I know that's how I got into college, was I went to a camp and I pitched well and I was offered a roster spot, and that would have never happened if I like didn't stop doing the showcase route.
Yeah, look, and I have so many young kids that come in here, high school kids, and they start talking about where they want to go. And oftentimes they're unrealistic with their expectations, right? And that's fine. We can have that conversation. But then when we start talking like, hey, I need you to make a list of schools that you, in this range, right? Like, I'm going to tell you where I think you can play. Find the schools that are within that range, but then figure out what you want to study. Like, what is it that you want to do with your life, right? Like, figure that, make sure it's all a good fit, and kids will come back and they'll give me schools. And I'll say, okay, cool. What do you want to major in? And they tell me, I was like, well, this school doesn't even have that program. It's like, do all of your homework before. Know exactly what you're getting yourself into, because you're making a big commitment, not just baseball wise, right? But your entire life, like you're making a huge commitment. You mentioned the experience with travel ball. So what are some of your things that you think are top priorities when you're looking at like travel ball stuff at the youth level?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me is having a good group to build around. I was extremely fortunate with the first travel team that I played on, where I started, I was 9 years old, and we ended when we were 16, and we had the same core group through all of those years. And like all the friendships that I made because of that, all the parents got along well, the coaches really cared. It was just a good experience growing up into like wanting to play baseball past the high school level into college. And that was really cultivated because of that group. And I was also fortunate that we were also good. We were one of the top teams in the state. So winning, of course, made it fun. But just the routine that we were put into and the atmosphere that was created there really helped me fall in love with the game. So if you're in a situation where you're playing travel ball just to play it and you're not really like looking forward to play travel ball because of the group that you're around, then maybe it's not for you. Maybe that's not the best course of action. But if you're able to find a group that you really coalesce with, then go for it. Do it. Have fun.
Perfect, perfect, perfect. Yeah, I mean, look, so most people aren't going to play baseball like for a living, right? But there's so it's so much bigger than just the baseball aspect of these youth baseball teams, right? Like having that sense of camaraderie, getting to know different people, working as a team, right? Making kids or allowing kids to fall in love with the game and not just push, where you're driving a bunch of kids away from the game. Because even if the kids aren't good, they may have a strong passion for the game later and stay involved in baseball. Like we need everyone. Not everyone, I don't mean like that, but we need a lot of people. It's going to take a lot of different people to be involved in baseball to push things forward, right? Not just the players who were extremely talented. There's a lot of great play, like a lot of good people in baseball and other sports as well that weren't the greatest players themselves, right? So it's important, I think, for the people running these teams to really have a sense of that it's not just about baseball. There's a bigger picture in mind as well. You got any thoughts on that? And otherwise, tell people how to find you before we wrap up.
Yeah, you hear more and more stories now of big leaguers who didn't start playing baseball until they were sophomores in high school. So like you can make your way to the big leagues no matter when you start. So like if you're noticing that you're not having fun playing in travel ball, then take a break. Like try to figure out what you like before throwing yourself into a time commitment such as trying to play collegiate or professional baseball, right? Because it's extremely time consuming. It'll take up pretty much every bit of your being trying to do those specific things. So if it's not for you in the specific moment, then move away for a little bit. I know for me, I had my experiences in high school where I really wasn't enjoying the game, like going to practices kind of just made me not want to be there. And like even the training and lifting wise, like I tried to make up excuses to not do all of those things. And I missed out in college because of those decisions. And if I could go back, I would work 10 times as hard in both the weight room and on the field in high school. And then in college, working through injuries where I wasn't really taking ownership of my own career kind of derailed that aspect of it. So I lost my career to arm injuries that I tried to pitch through. And I just didn't want to be the freshman who was hurt all the time. So I just kept going through it. And eventually my junior year, I tore my UCL and that was it. I wasn't going to have a senior season after that. Didn't have the junior season. So I focused on trying to work in baseball. And luckily for me, that worked out. And I'm incredibly grateful for that decision because I wouldn't be here if I didn't tear my UCL, most likely. So even the bad situations can end up being good ones if
Absolutely. If
you put in the work to make them better for you. So yeah, just make sure that you're taking ownership over your own careers if that's whether it's you're not having fun or you really want to go for it, make sure that you're putting everything into it.
Nice. And what about on social? You on social media? Where do people follow?
You can follow me on Twitter, Ryan Arowano, all lowercase, no space. All of my social medias are like that. LinkedIn, my GitHub for anyone who's aspiring to be on the data side of baseball. You can find my GitHub repositories with all my code in it. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, look, and just on that note, if anyone is listening that doesn't necessarily like have a strong desire to play baseball for a long time, but maybe just wants to get into the stuff like Ryan's doing now, I would encourage you to reach out to some facilities and do some of that work, right? But just to leave this, Ryan, before we go, just want to tell you this. I will forever be grateful for your time here. I'm proud of you, and I can't wait to see the work that you keep doing and where your career goes from here. So I appreciate you coming on, and good luck the rest of the way.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Harold.
Thanks for listening to the Mazingo Baseball Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the channel so you can get notified when the latest episodes are coming out. Share it with all your friends. Leave us a review. Be sure to check me out on all the social media accounts. It's going to be @MazingoBaseball. And check out the website, MazingoBaseball.com.